So we're on class two of this course, Becoming Your Best Self. And it's a fairly short course, maybe 6 weeks, I think. If you've only just joined tonight, that's okay because each class is a standalone topic, so it will make sense. It's based on Buddhist psychology, the Buddha's wisdom for understanding our mind, understanding our emotions, understanding our life, our environment. And then I've also brought in some kind of nice self-help neuroscience kind of things that I've found useful as well. So kind of quite well-rounded and relevant whether you're Buddhist or not. For the notes, some of you purchased notes, so the email, the PDF notes would have gone out at 6 o'clock tonight. If you've purchased notes and you haven't got them, please email the centre and we'll be able to sort it out. And if you wanted hard copies, there are some at reception as well. And the wonderful online people, if you could stay online after the class, then we can have a conversation, because I don't think I can get to your questions during tonight's class. I can't see the screen share in the class at the same time. Okay, so what we've covered already, I'm going to get screen share up now, just as a little recap. What we've covered so far, for those of you who were here last week, the three levels of happiness, or the three types of happiness. Happiness isn't just a kind of across the board thing, but there are different ways that we experience you know, pleasure, enjoyment, well-being, satisfaction. And so that the first level that we were looking at was what we get from the world, hedonic happiness, the kind of happiness that's just from being able to sit on a comfortable chair, for instance, and being able to hear properly, or having a nice family life. So fairly enjoyments that are circumstantial and that are a lot to do with our what comes in from our physical senses. Also enjoyment of cake, cheesecake, chocolate cake, whatever. The second level of happiness, a little bit deeper than that, what we bring to the world, eudaimonic happiness. So that's the kind of satisfaction that we experience that's deep, that lasts longer than a mood. We may be physically uncomfortable, but actually really happy in our heart. So from helping someone, being able to help someone that we love, or finding out some really good news from somebody that, you know, we really care about, even if our whole day has been terrible, we can feel really good about that. So it's how we contribute to the world, what we bring to the world, and largely it's dependent on not worrying about if we've got enough cake or not, or not worrying if we're comfortable or uncomfortable, because while we're preoccupied with those things, we miss the other ones. And third type of happiness, what we become, the kind of happiness that comes from within, that is a sense of confidence and clarity and peace in the mind, regardless of what's going on around us. So often we think we're happy when we're kind of happy-go-lucky, but this is actually being at peace in your heart, so not in conflict, not with that inner civil war or that profound discomfort that we sometimes have, but actually being that all of the realizations and the good-heartedness that we have. So there's a lot that we covered last week, and pretty much the takeaway from it was attachment to hedonic happiness distracts us from deeper human flourishing. So it means that delicious cheesecake, there's nothing wrong with it. And in fact, if we can kind of release our hedonic attachment, we'll even enjoy the cheesecake more. But our preoccupation. So we're going to kind of continue on with our attachment and preoccupations with this hedonic happiness, and how come it corrupts our best intentions and our good-heartedness. But before we do, for those of you who were here last week, the reflection sheets, The gratitude journal, did anyone have a go at those? Did anyone have questions, comments, feedback? You're nodding your head. James?
Yes.
Yes, how did you go?
With the 5 questions every day. Yeah, that's pretty good. I wasn't sure how many of the things that I would rate for as on it or.
Doesn't matter, really. Most of them are, yeah, that's right. Did you find that it actually made you appreciate those hedonic things more when
yeah,
you?
I think so. Probably, yeah.
Yeah. Or worrying about having more or something. Yeah. 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 So good, good. Excellent. Anyone else? Questions or comments? Yes.
So I think at the end of the day. Oh, okay. A nice reflection
on the day
instead of just going to bed and worrying about.
Yeah, and then your sleep would have been better as well, would have been more primed for the morning. Yep. And so how did you go? Were you able to find 5 things that you were grateful easily? Yeah. Right. Ah, good. So it's working. A lot of it is just that attention, what we're putting our attention to. Yeah, good. Any other comments or questions? About that. Well, okie dokie. So, this week, why are we here? We're going to have a look at the 8 worldly concerns. So, they are these worldly preoccupations or concerns, and they usually distract us from the things that really matter to us. So if you've ever kind of felt, you know, you've had a project or something you really, really wanted to do and you actually get distracted or you never get it finished or you run out of energy or someone says something and you just get completely deflated and lose all of your impetus for it. So a lot of these are to do with being dominated by these worldly concerns. Then how to keep a level head, how to not be demoralized, how to not be, sucked into being competitive or how to not be overwhelmed by doubts and procrastination. We'll have a look at the power of setting our intention. Hello, hello, come in, come and sit wherever you like. And the 2 types of motivation. And again, being able to recognize these 2 types of motivation means that we'll really be able to focus much easier. And hopefully by the end of it, we'll be able to see that whatever our goals are and what we're doing and our values all align. Because I know from my own point of view, I will ascribe to certain values, but then I look at what I'm doing each day and hopefully it's neutral and not bad, but you know, it's not necessarily actively supporting all those goals and values. So to get them aligned so we can actually live an authentic life. So let's just do a little meditation just to focus our mind, set our motivation, really think about why we're here. So first off, adjusting our posture so that physically we are comfortable, but just put a little bit of effort into keeping your spine straight. If your back is relatively straight, it's easier to concentrate. And imagine that there is a fine thread of light running through your spine from the base of your spine up through your body and out the crown of your head as if you're being pulled upwards by your crown. So you'll notice the natural curvature of the spine stays there, but your posture becomes a little bit more alert. And then make sure that you tuck the chin in as if you're going to make a double chin so that your chin isn't sticking out but pulling in, especially if you spend a lot of time on a computer. You should feel a little bit of pulling along the neck muscles. Relax the jaw, Put a slight smile on your lips. Rest the tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. And relax all the muscles around the eyes, the frown lines and the temples. Just release any tension held around the eyes. And let your eyes just be lightly closed or even just slightly open so some light comes in. Take a couple of deep breaths, and every time you breathe out, let go of any tension from the neck and the shoulders. Kind of pull your shoulders back a little bit so the chest and heart areas open. And then notice how you're sitting comfortably, ready to engage in the class. And then with the mind, just bring the mind inwards, just to becoming aware of the rising and falling of the breath. And in doing so, letting all the busyness of the day subside. Just like there's activity going on around you, but you don't have to be involved. So as well in our mind, there might be echoes of the day, but we don't have to get involved. Instead, just have your focus breathing in, breathing out. If you do notice that your mind is quite busy, that's okay. Without being judgmental about it, just note it as if you're noting what the weather's like. If your mind is tired or dull, then just open your eyes a little bit and recognize that's just the top layer. It's not all of you. And then take a moment to reflect what brought you to this class tonight. We've all put some effort into getting here, either online dealing with technology or coming in person with traffic and public transport and parking, timing. So why? So bring that initial motivation to mind. We use that as our starting point, and then we can adjust our motivation to take away any limits that we've put on it. So we can think that we're here not just for the alleviation of current problems or for our current plans, but actually to live a really good life and take the essence of this human life and to attain complete liberation from disturbing emotions, and even to become fully awakened, a Buddha, so we can perfectly help others. All of this is possible, so we can set that as our motivation. So with this really broad reason for being here and our focus starting where we are with our own life. And take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Open your eyes if they're closed. Okay. So, the topic today, how to not get distracted. And we could start with a question, I suppose, or how to not bite the hook. Why do we bite the hook? Why do we get distracted? Why do we get distracted from the things that we're doing? And also what distracts us from actually achieving the happiness that we want. So last week we talked about those three levels of happiness. So how come we're not automatically spending all of our time just, you know, going for that deep lasting inner peace? Why do we get distracted? So generally, what is distracting us from the happiness that we seek is something called preoccupation with worldly matters. So don't think that this is, again, some kind of moralistic value judgment. What a worldly matter is all of the stuff that happens to us that is unpredictable, that is unstable, fairly short term, unreliable. So pretty much most of our life, you know, where we live, how our family members treat us, what happens in our career, COVID comes along and just blindsides everybody, all of the uncertainty that comes from that. So much of our life is spent on these day-to-day worldly matters, but they're inherently unstable. And because we're preoccupied with them, what happens is we lose sight of why we're interested in those things in the first place. So we lose sight of really what matters to us. So this preoccupation with worldly matters, how come we even have that? I think because a lot of our focus goes outwards to what comes in through the senses. That's just a habitual thing. And then, of course, we become dominated by that. And then we try and make everything that happens to us good. We try and control it. We try and get career certainty, and we try and get a roof over our heads. And then, you know, we go from renting to owning a house thinking that it'll bring us more security. But no, it brings us more worries and all of these worldly things that suck up so much energy. So why are we enslaved to these worldly concerns because of something called cognitive fusion. So some of you might have heard of this term if you did any of Glenn Spencer's courses. He often said, don't do cognitive fusion, kind of like kids, don't do drugs. Well, humans, don't do cognitive fusion. So what is cognitive fusion? It's this terrible thing that happens to us again and again and again, which is judging the worth of an experience by how it feels. So if something feels bad, we just assume it is bad and then we try and avoid it. And if something feels good or feels pleasurable or feels nice, then we think it must be good for us, and so we gravitate towards it and want more of it. So that's called cognitive fusion, fusing the experience with the thing itself. And actually, most of how we judge experiences in the world comes from this, just an emotional sensation. Just like we have physical sensations, we have emotional sensations. Being with someone's pleasant or unpleasant. And then we judge whether it's good or bad from that. So let's see why that's a problem. So the eight worldly concerns. So they're divided into four pairs, seeking one thing and avoiding its opposite. And so the first two, seeking pleasant things and avoiding pain. So this is pretty obvious. Of course, we seek out nice food. No one goes to the shop and goes, I'm going to get the yuckiest food. You can see I have a preoccupation with chocolate mud cakes and cheesecake. But I'm not the only one, I know. And then avoiding discomfort or unpleasant things. So what this means is when we seek pleasurable or nice things, when we encounter things that are enjoyable, we're happy. And whilst we can keep on adjusting ourselves and adjusting our life, we think everything's going fine. It's only when we can't adjust it anymore. So for instance, we're all sitting on these chairs. When we first sit down, they're fairly comfortable. But you know, after an hour, you want to be able to wiggle. If you're not allowed to wiggle, you're going to be in trouble. after 2 or 3 hours, you know, like remember back in the olden days for long haul plane flights, being in a seat was agony. So it's still the same seat, isn't it? But it changes over time. When we are seeking the pleasant things, we might seek one slice of the chocolate cake. Oh, that was great. A second one's going to be even better. Possibly a third one will be three times as good. So all of those pleasant things, actually, they may not be any good for us. And if we're a diabetic, even just a tiny bit of cheesecake might be really pleasant. So that's that short-term hit with a long-term really detrimental effect on us. So why is it so hard to actually change our diet because of our habit to always go for just what's yummy? And that trumps everything. Whether we know that it's killing us or not, whether we know the sugar spike is going to get us emotionally or not. And the same thing happens with pain and discomfort. So anything that's uncomfortable, we try to get away from it. We get really displeased when we encounter unpleasant things. So if you can remember back when you're a kiddie and you had to take disgusting medicine, very, very rare children say, "Oh, mummy, please give me the medicine." Usually it's a real struggle. And even I was talking with Bruce just beforehand, and he's got to give his dog medication. Even the dog doesn't want the other medication. So it's not just us humans, is it? If you've had to take Chinese medicine, which is, but, you know, so how come we can is because we actually release this domination of avoiding pain and discomfort. How do we do that? Because we're thinking of the long-term benefit. If we just think about how disgusting it is, we just can't drink it, can we? Just can't do it. And, of course, another example of avoiding pain when it's when it really harms us is when we avoid going to the dentist. Has anyone here avoided going to the dentist? Yeah, a couple of you. So, there, you know, many people have a great terror of the dentist. And of course, if you avoid it for years and years and years, then when you finally get there, then they're like, "Well, your teeth are ruined now. It's too late." I think any like of the athletes, if you've been watching any of the tennis, they've managed to overcome these two because just training, it's not physically fun. The enjoyment comes from something else. Actually, it's a lot of pain and a lot of effort. So you, whilst we're beholden to these two things, then it's very difficult for us to put effort into things that matter to us. We just become overwhelmed. The next two, seeking gain, getting a bargain, profiting from things, acquiring more things, and avoiding loss or deterioration. So again, if anyone, you know, hoarding is such a endemic problem in our society because it's possible. I'm sure in other countries, if people had stuff, they would hoard it. It's just that they don't have the stuff to hoard. And beforehand, we didn't have all of the gadgets and the cheap things to start hoarding. But we have this idea more is better. And the bargain, so that's why I put the picture of a sale there, because it's, you know, that one, buy two and get one free. Woohoo! It's a bargain. And I didn't need any of them. And now I have three. So all of this, it works on us psychologically, whether we're aware of it or not. That's why people spend all that money on the advertising. And then once we've put good money in, then you've heard that saying, good money after bad. So even if we know it's not quite good, we have what's called loss aversion. So we just keep on giving more money so we can keep on thinking it's okay. And, of course, on the other side, avoiding loss, so difficult to release material possessions, upset when things break or are stolen, For a long time, I used to buy cheap shoes because I had the aversion from spending the money. But of course, then women's shoes, they just break immediately, aren't they? So at the end of the year, you've gone and bought 5-6 pairs of shoes and they all broke on your feet. So instead of actually paying good money for good shoes. So I was so fortunate one year, I was very, very poor, and my friend bought me R.M. Williams boots, and they lasted me 10 years. And that saved me thousands of dollars, which I didn't have. So, but why we go for the cheap, no good things is this loss aversion. We just don't like the idea of it. Another example of loss aversion is sometimes when I've heard about people getting mugged in New York back in the day or whatever, and what people get mugged for, they'll say, you know, give us your rings. And people go, no, you're not getting my wedding ring. So then they're shocked. So you've got this, no, no one's taking my wallet or my ring, instead of, yeah, make sure, here you are, have everything and walk away with your life. So that happens often to people, this kind of loss aversion. So before we go on, any questions or comments about these two things?
Deterioration.
Oh, well, I put here a picture of a balding guy because up on the top I put one of the shoes, sore feet. So the top one with the pain, avoiding pain, if you've got sore feet, you never want to go anywhere. And you might miss out on something really important. The loss aversion with balding. So that's the number one thing that guys spend money on in terms of the, you know, the cosmetic beauty industry, is to stop balding or to get hair implants. So then it's like, why? So it's just loss aversion and a cognitive fusion that happens, of thinking that we are how we look. So that's across the board. That's men and women. But I just thought, because women, it's pretty obvious with makeup, I'd stick poor old balding guy in there. So cognitive fusion really dominates us, even if we're educated about it. As we all know, we are not just our body. We aren't how we look like. And, you know, if we're old, we don't feel old inside. And often if we're young, we don't feel young inside. It's just how we look. And yet we still worry about it. We're still affected by it. What else? Anything else? Questions, comments about these? Can you see how they operate? Yeah. So this is a little bit... In itself, it's a little painful to look at, isn't it? But it's worth it because it'll liberate us from this kind of domination, that these worldly concerns, what I find is they corrupt what you want to be doing. So, you know, if I'm a bit tired and a bit lazy, so I'm avoiding the pain of putting in effort. So then I just, another day goes by and I haven't done the things that are really important to me. And then I go, how did that happen? Now the deadline's coming along. What? Okay, the next, praise and blame. Seeking praise, admiration, or approval. Seeking to be agreed with or encouraged or recognized. And avoiding blame, criticism, abuse, being denigrated, put down, scolded. So I just noticed this when I first started leading classes, I was really, really nervous. You know, they say public speaking is people fear public speaking more than they feel death. And I'm pretty sure that's true. So when I first started leading classes here, I was really confused because what happens, and especially in a meditation class, is that the more interior you get as you're thinking about things and reflecting, the less body language you're expressing. So what would happen, I'd look out at the class and everyone's just getting quieter and quieter and more and more blank. And I'm like, what? What's going on? So if I have a need then for acknowledgement back again, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because it stops that natural flow of becoming interior. And Australians, I think when we speak, when we just have a conversation, we'll nod and we'll go, yeah, 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 and we'll acknowledge that we've... Is that here? No, it's out there. That someone said something. And it's only when you go to another country where the response is a little different. So my German friend, when you talk, she'll be talking and she'll go, so? what? You know, is that the car? So? And, well, except you say it in German, so so. And it's just really abrupt, but that's what they do. They don't go yes, nod, smile. They don't go yeah, nah, like we do. They go so. So that kind of how the kind of response that we get from others, we really rely on it. And then if you go to a place or a culture where you don't get it, you start getting feeling invisible, and that's why you get culture shock. So when I was living in Melbourne, and I lived in East St Kilda or Balaclava, so that was an Orthodox Jewish suburb. It was a fantastic place to live. I loved it. And so me and my friends all living in an apartment building, all with wild hair, kind of pink and blue and leopard skin. And so most of the time we walked through wherever in Melbourne, we'd get yelled at. But when we walked through in Balaclava, we'd be completely ignored, like we did not exist. And it was uncanny. So in one way, because we were Gentiles, we just didn't figure. And it was a great holiday. But in another way, it was like, do I exist? Where am I? No one's giving me feedback, even if it's negative. So we really rely on that kind of feedback, approval or admiration from people. And if we get a little bit of a frown or something, it really rankles us. A white car? No. Straight parked straight out front. Go and have a check, and I'll send you the sound file to catch up on the little bit. Yeah. No worries, Lynn. There's something's awry. So, okay, so that's praise, admiration, being agreed with, encouraged. And if we're in a group of people and we're the only one and we're not being agreed with, it can rock our sense of worth, and we can start second-guessing ourselves. We can doubt our own ideas. So that way we can be manipulated by peer group pressure. And then we end up being divorced from our values. We're not now upholding our values. Now we're going with the flow of the group, and that has a really powerful effect on us. It's very difficult to be a whistle blamer. So on the other side of things, avoiding blame and criticism and abuse, if you're in an organization and you're a whistleblower, your life is going to be difficult, because everybody there won't like you because you've rocked the boat. All the bosses won't like you because you've exposed them. Your family won't like you because now you've lost your career and your job and your trajectory and money and security. You can find yourself really isolated. And yet, if you're not a whistleblower, if you know something really bad is going on, your conscience eats you up. So what are you going to do? Either way, it's painful. Either way, there's going to be difficulty. So which one can you live with? Whilst we make that decision by just how much blame or criticism or abuse that we're going to get, that's a real short-term one. And later on, our conscience will rankle at us. We won't sit well with ourselves. So from reading a lot of stories about whistleblowers in big organizations, that seems to be the thing. But at the same time, it's really, really difficult when you ruin your career. So just recently in the news, that lady who, you know, said that she was raped in Parliament House. So that takes a huge amount of guts to come out and actually say that. And her career is pretty much going to be ruined, even though it shouldn't be, it is. And who's going to employ her? Well, hopefully there's some employers now that will go, you have guts and ethics, I want you. But it's a really difficult thing to do. And so whilst we are pushed around by the need for praise and the dislike of blame, we cannot be true to ourselves. It's really hard. Another example about this is that we all seek the praise of our parents or the acknowledgement of our parents, that they, you know, acknowledge that we're good enough or what we've done or whatever, but we just want the good bits. We don't ever want their criticism. It's like, no, shut up. I don't want that bit. I just want the good bit. So at least I think if we can recognize these, how they function in our psyche, then we're more equipped to make a good decision about what we're going to do. Because once you see it in action, you can call it out. It doesn't dominate you anymore. And the last one, success and failure. The big F, failure. So we want to have success, to have a good name or good renown, high status, good reputation, flattering image. And many of us have a pathological fear of failure. How many things do we not do because we have a fear of failure or of making a fool of ourselves? So with the success, I was thinking about there's so many musicians and artists that in their own time were completely obscure, and in fact, and scientists as well, really belittled, humiliated by their peers. I mean, they've almost become mythological stories now, and it's only much, much later, probably when they've died, that they became acknowledged. So, you know, if that had have been the deciding factor with Mozart or with Van Gogh or any of those people or with countless scientists, then we wouldn't have the amazing world that we have now. But it takes a lot of guts to withstand it, to withstand our kind of instinctual need for success and our fear of failure. So many people won't follow a line of research or an interest if we get belittled by our friends, or if they just go, oh, what are you interested in that for? It'll really take the wind out of our sails. And I noticed just with my own artwork that whilst it's in the beginning stages, I can't show anybody, because just one word, even if it's of encouragement, but it's not enough encouragement. And I'll get really upset and deflated because you're far too vulnerable in that state. So it's much, much better to work alone till you really know you're on the right track. And then whether people like it or they don't like it, it doesn't matter. And, I mean, as an artist, that's the number one thing that you're supposed to be able to do, isn't it? You don't do it for the audience, that's interior decoration. You do it for the art, but to actually do that and not be, not have your art convoluted by this need for recognition, that's a tricky thing. So I tell you a really funny story about this. It also comes from the New Yorker magazine about success and failure. So it was the USA Defense Department, and they run their war games every couple of years to test out how they're going with being able to deal with terrorists and invasions and things like that. So they divide the department up into you guys are going to be the terrorists and we'll be the defenders, and we'll see how we go and we'll test all of our systems. So a few years ago now, they did these war games. So one general was the head of the terrorists, the guerrilla warfare. The other was the head of the army. So the guerrilla warfare guy, what he did was go, well, what do terrorists or guerrilla warfare people do? They don't abide by the rules. So he started his invasion the night before. The night before, it was supposed to all kick off at 9 a.m. And so then when all the rest of the army came, they'd had their breakfast and they're all ready. It's like, what? What's going on? And, of course, they were all at sixes and sevens and they stuffed everything up and they were invaded and you know, subjugated. And it was a great embarrassment. So can you imagine then what happened? Went up the line to Rumsfeld or whoever it was, and they looked at the results of how unprepared America was for a terrorist attack, and they went, this is no good. We have to run the war games again because we have to win. So they ran the war games again, and the guerrillas had to start at 9 a.m. with everybody else, and then they won, and then it's like, okay, and then they sent those results up. Oh, no, it's a bit of worry, isn't it? But that's what happens, isn't it? So what's more important is to be seen to be a success, not whether you can actually defend the country. And I think the guy, the general who played the army part, he was promoted, and the general that played the guerrillas, I think he was actually sacked. He was like, so just the step up there with the praise and the blame as well. If in some toxic workplaces, for instance, flattery will get you everywhere. If you flatter the boss, you'll get the raise. If you're a whistleblower, you'll get the sack. So a lot of how things are set up, at least to recognise, is your workplace or your school or your home, is it dysfunctional like this? Is it running purely on the eight worldly concerns? Or is there something deeper? Are there some real ethics and values underpinning things that help you, you know, not just be pushed around by these? And at least to be able to recognise, oh, right, this is why I get so tired at work, because I'm in a toxic workplace. That explains everything. So we don't have to take it personally and actually acknowledge then how much work you do to withstand these. So if we look at those eight pairs, what kind of ratio, again, I like ratios, what kind of ratio during the day do we spend being preoccupied with those things? And how much of the time do we think about our long-term goals, about contributing towards the world, about, you know, helping others? What's the ratio, folks? Come on. Who's about, like, 20-80? 20, all the good stuff, 80 worldly concerns. Who's less, like 95, 98% worldly concerns? Yeah. This is an embarrassing in itself. It's okay. You can put your hand up. We can all proudly get an F because it's better to recognise it. So even Lama Zorpa Rinpoche, who's depicted here on the throne, just a few years ago, he said, after he came out of one of the retreats, he said, everything in my life up to now has been motivated by the worldly concerns. I haven't even been a proper Dharma practitioner. And Lama Zorpa Rinpoche is an amazing yogi and an incredible teacher and wholeheartedly altruistic. And for him to say that his mind was dominated by the eight worldly concerns, I just went, oh, my God, what hope is there for us? But I think also I'm pretty sure there's degrees, isn't there? So at the minimum, we can see how they're playing out in our life and call them out for what they are. So let's just take a moment to think, well, what are the three most important things to you at the moment? So just take a moment to think. What's the most important thing to you at the moment? And then two other things. So the most important thing to you at the moment might be a project or an event or an issue going on in family. The most important thing, what comes to mind. And then there might be a couple of other things you go, okay, they're also really important. And so then if you think of those things that you feel are the most important to you, those things or those people or activities, then just think about the last week and how much of your activities supported those things. How much of the stuff that you did, how you spent your time. So that'll give you an idea of, you know, of how much energy is being frittered away, whether we're really aligned with what matters to us. I know I go really up and down with this one. Ah, that's right. And now the other thing with success and failure. So again, we've had the tennis in Melbourne and everyone's playing those games. They want to win, don't they? And I'm pretty sure if Ash Barty doesn't win, if she comes second, there's going to be not just her but a whole lot of people that are going to go, oh, no, she came second. But actually, when you look at it in terms of success and failure, that's like second in the world. So success and failure, again, how we look at them and how the only way you'd be able to sustain yourself as an athlete is not to fixate on winning or losing, or you end up like the Australian swimming team that, you know, got only silver and got castigated for it, for getting only silver at the Olympics. So having that fixation on external success or external failure, it's not sustainable. It's why so many elite athletes end up being suicidal, having like really hard time when they retire, when they're no longer getting medals, because of this cognitive fusion of thinking, failure, if I fail, I am a failure. The failure and me are the same thing. That's a big mistake. As well as thinking that getting silver is failure, which is also a big mistake. So they're very relative things when we start looking at it. And many of the elite athletes will actually say what determines whether you're a success or failure is whether you do your own personal best or not. So you may not win the medal, but you'll feel much better inside. Okay, so before we go on to the next bit, questions, comments?
Yes. You have to make mistakes the whole time.
Thank you. See, I even forgot to put that in. Failure is as important as success.
And that actually in evolution in terms of failure is very important because the genetic mutations. When the genetic mutations happen in species, they 98% of the time they'll be disastrous for that particular individual because they won't be able to survive. But every now and then that one give them advantage of something.
So actually evolution is this series of daring to fail, and then every now and again one of those things will actually. Thank you, that's right. So there you go. So if we were dominated by cognitive fusion, we'd miss all of that. We'd think it, and it's just because it kind of feels bad. So it's that thought, feels bad is bad. That's a mistake. So even if we just recognize that and go, yeah, failure, it's difficult, but it's not necessarily bad. In fact, it's super important. So thank you. Yes. That's right. It only matters if you try your best. Yes. Because if you try your best, you have come first for yourself. Yep. And actually, Getty's Opus said that when thinking about the end of the year, the way that he dedicated for the end of the year, he said, anything that you've done to your best ability, feel really good about it. Well, I hope you get your leadership thing, whatever it is, Mia. All right, so then let's have a look. They're the eight worldly concerns, the power of good motivation. So how we actually can counter those worldly concerns is to get proactive about it before they start taking over and set our motivation, actually bring some awareness to our motivation. So what drives us? What gets us out of bed in the morning? So apart from the need to go to the loo, what gets us out of bed in the morning? You know, necessity and what else? How come you got up today and ended up here and didn't just spend the day in bed? What was the reason? Anybody? How come you got up today?
I was just trying to think about that.
Was it just like habit or?
Yeah, probably habit.
Probably habit? Because yeah. Because that's what you do in the morning, you get up? What else? Does anyone get up in a panic? Going, oh, no, I've got to do this. Or, oh, no, this thing's happening today. No one has that? Oh, what a relaxed life. Right, so if you don't have an, oh, no, I've got to get up, what makes you get up? Lynn, what makes you get up? Got to go to work. Does anyone have that? Got to go to work? Yeah, a few of you. Okay.
Fun things to do.
Fun things to do. Does anyone have that? A thing that you're looking forward to or anticipating? One person? Come on. One and a half people. You like going to work. That's good. That's a double thing. Okay. What about just habit? You get up because you get up? That's what you do? Yeah, okay. What about money?
You've got a goal, like you've got something.
Yep, a goal, something to achieve. Used to be an overseas holiday. Now I'm not quite sure how to do that one. So what about to prove someone wrong, you know, or to prove to your parents that you're as worthwhile as the rest of the family? Or the people that didn't get out of bed and didn't make it here today, maybe it was just overwhelmed by depression and didn't get up. There wasn't a reason for getting up. You might have a whole range of those. Most of the time, though, it's on autopilot, isn't it? We just do because we do. So we've got to have a look at this of what propels us into the day. Yes.
Sorry, but yeah. I've got a funny one. Because it would be embarrassing if you didn't.
Because it'd be embarrassing if you didn't. Well,
like your partner would just go, what are you doing?
Oh, see, I clearly have no sense of shame. But actually, that's true, yeah. We think of our reputation. What would people think of us? It's like when people come to visit, it's like, quick, clean the house. Because what will people think of us? So that's true, yep. So that your partner doesn't roll their eyes at you. So the clearer the goal, the stronger our success will be. So think of those things that really matter to us. We have to think about them in the morning. If we don't think about them, our whole day will be distracted. That's just a given. And not only that, it will probably degenerate. The motivation that we set in the morning will carry us through the day. So if it's unconscious or if it's just autopilot, then our whole life will be. So I got this little picture of someone doing a long jump because one of the lamas that taught here for a few years, Geshe Jamyang, had just this great skill with analogies. So he said, a motivation is like the run-up to the long jump. The run-up is everything. How you do that run-up, the timing, how much effort you put into it, because once you're in the air, there's very little you can do. So what is that run-up? That is our motivation before we get up or before we leave the house. And then the day is launched. It's already in that direction and there's very little we can do. So how we can adjust our motivation, because we might want to save the world, we might want to cure cancer and cure COVID, but few of us actually get a chance to have first-hand kind of experience with that. But we can still make our life highly meaningful, highly worthwhile. So a really easy way to do this is to adjust our motivation. And a way we can do it is by asking why three times. So I've got to get up, why? So my partner doesn't roll their eyes at me. So why does that matter? And you might go, well, what they think matters to me, and go, well, why? And hopefully you get to, well, they're a good person and I want to do them proud, or I want to support them in life. So you can see you've got to show the workings, or you've got to go to work. So why? Why do you go to work? Why does anyone go to work? To pay the bills. Why? Why pay the bills? Why not just like be done with it and go homeless? Responsibilities. So that's getting there, because if you just go, I'm just going to work to pay the bills, well, frankly, that's why I stopped, because that's not enough. Maybe you don't want to live on the street, or maybe you've got a goal of how you want to live. So then you go, okay, so the responsibilities, people to care for. So when you're going to work, instead of going, I hate this job, you're thinking, I'm going to work to support the ones I love. And then you can go to work with a happier mind. And face it, most of the world has a crappy job. So how are you going to keep a happy mind for that, is to think of why you're doing it.
The work I do, I'm a support worker for disabilities. So the people rely on me.
They rely on you. That's right. Human beings literally rely on you. Yep, and that's a powerful thing.
That's great for me. And I know I'm doing good.
Yeah. Yeah, and so if you're feeling a bit down one day, do you go, oh, no, I'm going to put my head back under the...
I still do it. Yeah.
So that's it. That's the pull of that, of the responsibilities and the care for others, is stronger than the pull of tiredness or depression or all of those things. Yeah. So we got to start asking why, and we get short term, medium term, long term. So most of the time we'll go to medium term, a good career or a holiday or a house or see my folks or all of those things, and it kind of stops there. But we got to think longer than that, our whole life. So with an athlete, this is where they really get into trouble, because they just think to the peak of their career and not afterwards. And then afterwards, now they're like 20 years behind everybody else in worldly skills and earning money. They don't know how to do it. So long, long term, and from a Buddhist point of view, it's not even just this life. It's like a future planning. And the other thing, two purposes. We've got to have a purpose for ourselves and a purpose for others. And like you're saying, Lynn, if we don't have, and you're nodding your head, two responsibilities, if we don't have a reason for others, it's just not enough to live. And many people will say, especially when you're completely overwhelmed by depression, you just need one other living being to care for and you can get through it. And usually it's a pet. And many people will say, I didn't kill myself because who's going to feed Rover? And that's it. That's the reason why you're still alive. So for others, if our goal includes the benefit of others, if we stretch it out to include the benefit of others, it will keep us pure and it'll keep us going and happy. If it's just for us, if it's just me time and we don't ask why me time, it's not enough. We'll get more cranky and more distracted. Okay, and a question that I got from Facebook. What would you be doing right now if you knew you couldn't fail? So I know I had a whole list of things that immediately jumped to my mind with that. What would you be doing right now if you were doing it for others? So I've kind of put this together so we can see when there is a discrepancy between our ideas and our hopes and longings and how we're actually living our day-to-day life. So the motivation, let's have a look at, there's two types of motivation. And so causal and momentary. So someone actually said, oh, I really like Buddhism because they have casual motivation at the moment. It's really chill, man. But no, causal and momentary. So that means actually it's not what you're doing throughout the day. You can just be a cleaner, bus driver, something without much status. But what makes it important is why. And that's something we bring to it. So the causal motivation pretty much is what drives us, what gets us out of bed during the day, and a lot of times it's unconscious. We're motivated just by our habitual hedonic happiness, want to go to the loo, want to have breakfast, or want to make some money to go on a holiday, or might be a little bit more the worldly things, the approval of our parents, the approval of our spouse, to protect ourselves from poverty, to beat the competition. So a lot of those things aren't very sustainable, but they do drive us from day to day. And that causal motivation then flavors how we react throughout the day. So that's the momentary one. So when we're reactive, when we're going through our day and someone does something and we just retaliate, we get reactive back. Where does that come from? That comes from our causal motivation. So however we start the day off, it goes in that direction. And then what happens to us, how that momentary reacting in the moment, that'll be influenced by it. So if we wake up in a panic, full of anxiety, how am I going to pay my bills? What am I going to do? And it's just narrow. And then we go out into the world. How we respond to everything that happens to us is going to be flavored by that, even if it's people trying to help us. So the momentary motivation. And then I've also found that many times throughout the day, then we'll do something that's important to us and we'll have to make this huge effort to focus. Why am I doing this again? We go to a meeting or something boring. Why are we here? What are we doing again? Looking at the form, can't read it. So why? It's because suddenly in the moment we have to set our motivation. We have to remember why we're there and what it's all for. And it takes a huge amount of effort. Whereas if we had a set in the morning, oh, yeah, that's right, I've got to do all the emails and the admin and the online things because of class tonight. Why are we doing a class? Because I want to be able to liberate all sentient beings from all of their sufferings forever. So then I come to class, then I can focus. So Buddhist motivation, of course, an altruistic intention for others. for oneself doesn't have much power, but for others, as we know, you know, it really gives us energy. Bodhicitta, doing it for the biggest good, not just band-aid measures or not just alleviating a little bit of suffering here or a little bit there, but for the big one, complete liberation and awakening. Really good non-religious motivation, looking after one's family. When people look after their family, they can do just about anything, can't they? Contributing to society, giving back in some way, paying it forward. So we've got to be proactive, and this is the very minimum we can do as a decent human being. Today, I'm going to try to benefit whenever I can, and at the very least, I will not harm. It's great, isn't it? So we can all say that before we get out of bed, and that becomes your causal motivation. Then everything you do that day, you won't have to think, oh, what am I doing again? You'll just naturally refrain from saying nasty things back or, you know, retaliating. All of our energy is already in that direction. So Lama Yeshe had this wonderful thing to say. What's the purpose of being alive today? It must be something more important than drinking coffee or paying the bills. To live merely a coffee existence is not worthwhile. It is far better to dedicate this day to the development of bodhicitta, leading to the peaceful path of liberation and full awakening for the benefit of all living beings. So this is how you start the day with Dharma wisdom. So instead of following your ego's instinctive call for coffee, you wake up carefully, alert to your internal feelings and state of mind, and then establish the motivation that will take you through the rest of the day. Make the strong determination, from this moment on until I go to sleep, I shall stay aware of every action of my body, speech and mind. And in this way, I shall maintain control, creating for myself a peaceful internal environment. If you establish this kind of mind in the morning, you won't have to keep reminding yourself of your motivation throughout the day. Even if you encounter an angry person who shouts at you, you will remain controlled. This doesn't mean that you squeeze yourself, suppressing your hatred forcefully. Your self-control will be natural and calm, coming from a deep recognition of what is going on in your mind. So, in terms of life hacks, this is a really big one. So I've got some examples about functional and dysfunctional motivations. So with sexuality, for instance, we can have a look at causal motivations and momentary motivations. So if we're in a relationship with someone and it's a healthy relationship, and the whole purpose is actually, you know, we're trying to be an authentic human being, to be honest, to share emotion, and to give and get pleasure. So that's the causal motivation. A healthy, healthy relationship, they're like, you know, sharing our common humanity. But to actually get into the sack, we've got to have some form of desire or lust. So that's the momentary motivation. If we don't, then it's just a platonic friendship. But often what will happen, here's the dysfunctional one, the causal motivation is there underneath. It's quite selfish, quite needy, scared of being alone, needing the acknowledgement of others. Just being really hedonistic, wanting to lord it over others and have power over others. So all of that can actually be what's driving us to be in a relationship. And on the surface, the momentary motivation, you might be all nice and attentive and romantic. So whether it's us being like that or we've been in a relationship like that, that after a while we find out that all that nice romantic attentiveness, actually what's driving it underneath is something quite other, dysfunctional. And that's because of this difference between those two types of motivation. It really shows how important it is that we discover what our causal motivation is and then adjust it. So Buddhist psychology is quite different from Freudian or Jungian psychology, which kind of looks in below and sees, whoa, what deep dark things are happening under there, la, la, la. Buddhist psychology looks what's happening and goes, no problem, we can change it. This is my causal motivation, not so happy with that, let's adjust it. So you start where you are and you just adjust it with words. You use your words to change it and it works. So with the dysfunctional relationship and especially with dysfunctional sexuality, if what's just driving you is just pleasure, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're expecting to actually have some kind of connection from a relationship, you won't get it. So then what happens is you just start feeling really alienated or lonely or feeling quite hollow inside. And so then because we're drawn outwards to the senses all the time, then you might end up being a sex addict by thinking, I'll just have more sex and then I'll feel better. But if we don't work with what that causal motivation is inside, we won't get that actual satisfaction. Okay, so then the other example I had for you, becoming a doctor. So a healthy reason for wanting to become a doctor is because you like human beings and you want to help them. It's no good if you don't like human beings, right? You want to be able to alleviate their suffering. But to study to be a doctor, how many years does it take? 7, 10, 14? Countless years of sleep deprivation and 1 year of statistics. I haven't come across anybody who likes statistics. So how does a doctor, someone studying to be a doctor, get through those statistics? Not by moaning and groaning about how awful it is, but they're thinking about the bigger picture. I just got to get through this year. It's got nothing to do with helping anybody. I mean, with all these dusty books and calculations and this and that, and my head is swimming, what's that got to do with alleviating someone's suffering? So the momentary motivation, you can't force yourself. Many people drop out in the year of statistics because they're lost track of the causal motivation. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? So the momentary one, you've got to have some kind of striving for good grades. You've got to have some kind of competitiveness to keep you going, but it can't be the main reason. And if it is, you're most likely to drop out. So anyone, you know, who's studying, who's at uni, you've got to have a bigger reason for than just to get grades or just to, you know, the career. It's got to be why, something that'll carry you through. And what I found with some bad experience of doctors for a dysfunctional reason, so the causal reason might be just status. You got good grades, you're super smart, become a doctor. You're pushed into it by your parents and you don't even like human beings. Or you didn't quite get a good enough grade, so you pushed into veterinary science and you don't even like animals. And I've met vets that don't like animals, but they just didn't get into medicine. And so the pressure that also comes from one's parents, the expectations of one's parents, is a big driving factor for a lot of high-powered careers. And so then you might have a doctor that's all nicey-nicey and smiley and momentary motivation, everything's fine, until you ask a question. And then they go, how very dare you? So my friend was actually thrown out of the doctor's surgery for asking a question about the operation that they had to have because the doctor felt that their status was being questioned. Don't you know who I am? I am the best surgeon on the Gold Coast. It's like, yeah, whatever. I want to know the answer to my question. So if your purpose is status, then emotionally you'll be really vulnerable and it'll come out like that of getting angry, of asserting power. So that's why I put friendly only if unchallenged. And if you ever do come across a doctor or a vet like that, seek a second opinion. And, I mean, the professionals like that, doctors that do that, they do themselves a disservice because they actually might be a really good doctor. But with this causal motivation being really dysfunctional, how are you going to trust that they're looking out for you? So questions or comments about my examples? Anyone got any other examples? Or anyone here studying at the moment? Is it useful for why? Yeah? Okay. Anything that you're going to change or adjust?
Maybe just go back, think about what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and don't be frightened to spend some time asking why. So ask why, and if you don't get the answer straight away, that's all right. Give yourself a couple of weeks to really bring your whole psyche inwards to investigate it. Yeah, because often we'll find our unconscious motivation, but then we've got to bring a motivation to it and build it up. Yeah. All right, so then just a little word, well, how our attachment ruins everything. So attachment in Buddhist psychology has a very particular meaning. It's quite different from if you hear about Western psychology, you might hear about attachment therapy or whatever it is. That's a good thing. But in Buddhism, attachment has a very specific meaning. And it does ruin everything. It ruins everything that's enjoyable. It's so ironic. So attachment is a distorted state of mind. And it thinks it's got cognitive fusion. If something feels good, therefore it is good. If something is pleasant, therefore it's good for me. So anyone who's got a food allergy will know there is a cognitive fusion going on here and you've got to withstand it, that something might be really, really yummy, but it isn't good for me. Attachment in terms of relationships overvalues or overestimates the benefit that's going to come from the other person. Actually, the benefit comes from having a functional relationship. It doesn't come from them. Attachment is biased. It sees only the good things and none of the drawbacks. And it's where all of our expectations and assumptions and projections come into play. So many times we don't even know we have attachment until it changes, until it's thwarted in some way. So attachment's very, very tricky because it starts ruining things early before we even notice. So our attachment to comfort or to a good reputation, and our fear of failure, for instance, it will hold us back. It'll hold us back from experimenting or being brave. So it ruins things. Our attachment to just pleasure and having fun. I look back over my life and I had some quality fun. You could make a movie about it, but a lot of it was just wasted time. And when I asked the reason, well, why? What was the fun for? Then you're really getting to something. But otherwise, what happens is even if all those things were fun and turned out really well, what it means is 15 years of my life is gone. So all of those other things that I should have been doing now are 15 years late. So cognitive fusion means we're enchanted by the appearances of things. And many times we're enchanted by the allure of a family life or the allure of a career. Or the perfect job or the perfect this or the perfect that. You know, we overestimate. We just see all the good things. We don't want to hear about the drawbacks. We become completely enchanted and then we get there and then it's a rude awakening or it takes a whole lot of upkeep. It also means that we conflate people with their behavior, especially people who act negatively. You think of anyone who you dislike at the moment, you think, oh, they're a horrible person. You don't think they are a wonderful potential Buddha who's undergoing a whole lot of stress and worldly concerns. Pick a politician, any politician, we conflate them with their behavior. And we conflate all the pleasant experiences with the person. So any good relationships that we have, we think it comes from that other person. So cognitive fusion, this Western term, is one of the main things that Buddhist psychology deals with. They just didn't call it that. But all of Buddhist psychology is about freeing us from cognitive fusion in all of its many aspects. So how do we keep a level head? Here's some just really practical things to do. Recognize the drawbacks of attachment. How when we have attachment to a person, a relationship, the perfect job, the chocolate cake, the cheesecake, what it does is it stresses us so much and our expectations get so big that what's there right in front of us we can't enjoy. So like the gratitude journal that we're doing, you know, we start looking at those things that have been there in front of us the whole time and we've even forgotten to enjoy them. And yet they're amazing when we actually look at them. And even though we constantly think our happiness comes from outside of us, actually the reason we can enjoy anything is because we are peaceful inside. So I went on a cruise years ago where I was just astounded by how pampered everybody was, and it was just a real holiday for me because I didn't have to organize anything. So for me, that's my definition of a holiday. So I was in seventh heaven the whole time. But the rest of the people there were complaining. And I'm thinking, here you are with your own butler and you're complaining. And so on one of them, we had this dinner and the dinner was delicious and it was all served beautifully. And the lady next to me is like, oh, no. This is such an amazing dinner. Tomorrow's dinner is bound to be a disappointment. Like, what is it going to take? So it was really clear that it doesn't matter how amazing our circumstances are, if we aren't satisfied in our mind, it's just not going to do it for us. So we have to look within.
That means
being grateful. Being grateful. Yeah. And recognizing that a sense of satisfaction doesn't come from that dinner. It comes from the ability to enjoy things. And this is the real curse of an affluent society, is that we have this option to keep on getting stuff, thinking that it'll come from out there. We're never thrown back on ourselves, or rarely, to go, actually, I have to learn how to have a happy mind. In the house that we have now, you know, compared to the whole rest of the world, it's pretty amazing. So be realistic yet optimistic. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama says we can use our innate human intelligence to see whatever situation there is, there's going to be an opportunity, there's going to be a way that we can benefit, even painful situations. So even with COVID, there's been ways that people have benefited. There's been ways we've benefited. So it doesn't mean that it's pleasant, but we can really get something from it. So it's actually not the external situation that is the deciding factor at all of whether something is good or not. And don't sweat the small stuff. So we talked about this last week as well. If we can recognize the impermanence of our life, how it's fleeting, how all of these things that we could be tempted to complain about, they'll be gone soon anyway. So what actually matters? What really matters to me? Is it that small stuff that we get so, hyper-focused on? So I remember years ago I was going to go on a road trip with my boyfriend from Melbourne up to Brisbane. And the day beforehand, he broke his wrist. And we weren't driving. Someone else was driving. It was three of us. And he said, I've broken my wrist. The trip's off. I'm like, well, why? You're just sitting in the car. It's like, well, I can't go anywhere. I've broken my wrist. So we didn't really stay together very long. But that's the kind of thing that when we're just focused on those worldly concerns, it becomes all-encompassing and you miss the fact that, yeah, you can go on the trip, you've got a broken wrist, but it's okay, actually becomes a talking point. Actually, it's a way of breaking the ice with all sorts of strangers in the town. And then I remember Sally Pearson, the it's not hoops, is it? The hurdles jumper. It's a bit ironic I mention all this sport because I don't know anything about sport. But she was doing the hurdles and she slipped and she broke her wrist, didn't she? Remember, it's thought pain because on the TV you saw the bone sticking out. Oh, my God. And then after she'd kind of recovered a little bit and it was all strapped up, she said, oh, I'm so lucky, to the news person. So why? She was so lucky, genuinely thankful that it was just her wrist and she didn't break her ankle. So probably the only person I know of in the world that felt lucky after breaking her wrist, but it was genuine. So again, it's not the thing out there, it's what we bring to it. Also, just recently I've been watching these shows, Ambulance, about the first responders. So there's an Australian one and there's an English one. And so one of the ambos was saying every day that they go into someone's house, it's a privilege. It's an incredible privilege to go into their house. So that's how to not sweat the small stuff, because they're not worried about is their hair done. They're not worried about the state of the house. They're not worried about if the person's all messy or not, because of course they are. They need an ambulance. What matters is human beings helping each other, being kind. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a how to keep a level head in the face of those worldly concerns that dominate us and bully us. I think of them as bullies. So at least when you see them operating in your mind, even if you can't withstand it, even if you still got a fear of failure, recognize it as a bully in your mind. You go, all right, oh, whatever, you know. I might lose the battle, but I'm going to win this war. Before we do the summary, questions, comments? Hopefully it's clear. So the preoccupations with worldly concerns distracts us and corrupts us. And hopefully you've got some really practical strategies how not to bite the hook. Cognitive fusion means we are a slave to the belief that our happiness comes from outside, from those things and people out there. And that's a habit of lifetimes. So at least to start recognizing it at play. And what drives it all? is our attachment. Oops, our attachment makes us miss out on enjoying the things that we actually enjoy. And makes us miss out on help and recognizing other great things from outside of, you know, from others. And all of our expectations and assumptions ruin what's there. So we can actually, just by setting our motivation in the morning, change it all. It'll have a profound effect. So the homework, finish, there's self-reflection sheets from today, and compose a morning motivation. So even if it's just write it out on a post-it note, whatever happens, I'm going to try and help, and if I can't help, I'm not going to harm. But you might want to put in something else, like Lynn, you might have, and the people I'm going to help, may I help them the very best. And, you know, or may I absolutely ace my studies so I can be a good human being so that everybody I encounter can feel safe. Just really simple things like that. Start writing your morning motivation. If you've got aiming for a holiday, why? Even if it's just to de-stress, why? So writing it down is going to take effort, but it'll change everything. All right, and then just before we do a dedication, then next week we're going to have a look at what are called the three higher trainings. For total fulfillment, well, three higher trainings for how to, the three things we need to train in to be a good human being. So these are like three skills. They're things that we can develop so that we can become an excellent human being, benefit ourselves and benefit others. So they're called ethics, concentration and wisdom. But again, there's some little tricky things about that, and I'll have some stories for you too. So let's dedicate the merits. So we've spent all of that effort to get here and then concentrate and reflect, courage to do all of that. We can dedicate for the person having the argument outside. We can dedicate that whenever we're faced with aggression, that we don't meet it with aggression, that we meet it with understanding and kindness and patience. And we can dedicate that we are not our behaviour, and may we recognise that in ourselves and others. And that we can make the very most of our life so we can contribute to the world in a positive way. And not just an immediate positive way, but all the way to complete liberation from disturbing emotions for ourselves and others, bringing everyone along with us. Who has something to say? Question, comment, just wave at me. Who wants to go first? Anne, okie dokie, go for it.
Trying to pick the most important one. when you were talking about success and failure, like in the worldly concerns, I've noticed getting older, which I am, that things are less of a concern than, say, you know, like even in the last 5 to 7 years, there's been a shift. And I just thought that was interesting because I hadn't really thought about that till now.
Yeah, I think as we get older, a lot of those concerns naturally fall away. And like I just noticed, for instance, I'm not terrified to get on a bus with a whole lot of school kids anymore, but it took several decades before that happened. But
I still am.
But I think why that matters is because you do, hopefully, as you get older, start figuring out what actually does matter. And isn't that amazing? Once you do, those other things, you just don't care about them anymore. They do just drop away. Mm. And there's a real freedom in that.
Yeah, it's quite nice. I mean, there have been things that jump in and take the place, but but you know, it's you're able to generally kind of deal with them a little bit better. I mean, there's always an exception, but yeah.
Yeah, or like what I noticed here, I can have a really good motivation to start with, but it might deteriorate if I don't maintain it.
Yeah.
So this can happen, that you just start getting frittered away with worldly matters. It's like we have at the beginning of the year a whole lot of really good intentions, and by the end of the year, you know, we've forgotten half of them, and that's because those distractions come in, and it's because we don't maintain our motivation. Okie dokie, Tracy.
I feel like I can't remember everything. Like, there's a lot of information coming in, and I'm a psychology, Freudian psychology major, and it's so very different, and it makes a lot of sense. But I feel like, yeah, it's so different that I can't remember it from one minute to the next. Yeah. Like, I reread the notes that you sent me probably four times since yesterday, and it's still just not going in there. But I figure...
Yeah, well, give it more than a few days, Tracy. Because, I mean, how long have you been studying psychology?
Oh, years. Yeah.
Well, there you go. So a lot of it is familiarity. And when you study Buddhism, it's quite different from studying academically, because it's part of it is learning, understanding, memorizing, getting the list, being able to, you know, put it together, but most of it is about application into your own life. So there's no point in having a theory unless you actually live it. And that's a really different approach to an academic approach, which tries this theory and that theory and, you know, all these different perspectives and even makes up theories. So
that disconnect happens, because academically you can sort of emotionally reason through different types of theories, whereas having to actually apply it to yourself and your own behaviours, which might be, you know, unconscious or not that obvious to you, is a bit of a challenge.
It is, yeah. And like, you know, with Jungian psychology, people go into psychoanalysis, don't they, for years?
Yeah.
And that's part of it, and I think that's a real acknowledgement that to be a good therapist, you yourself have to be good at being in therapy as well. Otherwise, how are you going to have that depth of empathy and understanding for others? So, so Buddhist study is a bit like that too. And I think with Westerners, people can you can very quickly grasp the intellectual part, but it can be a bit of a trap. Because actually then once you start applying it, it feels like you're way back at kindergarten, you know nothing and you feel really clumsy and it's like, oh, my God, what's going on? But that's because of that really different approach.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's probably a good sign, actually.
Oh, okay.
Can I just ask
one more thing? The focus in Buddhism on altruism, is there like outreach programs that you offer to, like, I don't know, homeless people, or like is there activities that we can join that help people in the community?
Yeah, so that kind of community service is very fledgling in Buddhism in Australia, because, you know, it's only been like, you know, a couple of decades, you know, 30, 40 years, as opposed to 100, 200 years of the church. So every now and again, say someone will say, why aren't there any Buddhist op shops? Because, well, we haven't been established enough to have that kind of thing. So there are small projects around the place. In our organisation, FPMT, there are hospices. A lot of them are overseas, the leprosy projects and schools and animal sanctuaries. So there are a few things in Australia. Mostly it's hospices to help people die without fear. And then before COVID, what we used to do was every month or two go out to an animal sanctuary read sutras, bless the animals, and all of the donations that came in for that event we'd offer to the animal sanctuary. So, you know, some kind of community events like that. And our food from the pujas we now offer to the homeless. But, you know, it's really fledgling start.
That'd be something I'd be really interested in.
Yeah, okay. It's really difficult now with COVID. I was looking at those things for the animal sanctuaries again, and even that, it's quite fraught as to how to organise it, but it will come back onto our program.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
And you had a second question too?
It was just a reflection for Tracy and possibly Mark, depending, but I was going to say I've got an academic background, Tracy. Counselling, and I did a master's in counselling, very intellectual. I worked in the justice system, very intellectual. I've been studying at Langri Tangpa, I don't know, it's kind of like 16 years. I'm still studying Discovering Buddhism, so I feel like I'm in kindergarten, but and that's like 16 years now. I may not be as fast-tracked as the others, but I don't pitch it that way. It's just like this is really I've had to kind of do that head shift. That's part of, like, if you want to call it a block, because I've been trained so well to be intellectual and analytical in the sense that we have in the West. This is a very different analysis. So, yeah. And so I'm back doing Miffy's class, even though I'm doing Discovering Buddhism, because I really need to bring it back into everyday life.
And so you probably will feel a little bit like kindergarten, but that's because it takes a huge amount of effort to walk the talk, to apply it. So
unless you've got friends at kindergarten too now, then.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and we have to be as patient with each other as we are too, you know, with kindy, with our Dharma brothers and sisters. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
And
Mark, how about you? How are you going?
So 16 years. So I was hoping to get the answers like this week or maybe next week.
Well, you can, but you know, even just if you just go, okay, for this week, I'm going to set my motivation every morning. See if you can do it. Because if you can, then you've got the answers. But
yeah, certainly the 8 worldly concerns, I can completely, like, certainly in my day-to-day quick thinking, you know, when you're not properly reflecting, when you're just getting on with your day, I would say 99.9% of my focus is all of those things. And they really ring true. Failure and success and criticism and praise and all that stuff. But it's definitely one thing to recognize those things and another thing to be able to in the moment do something about it. That's a huge step.
And those things, like, there isn't anything wrong with success or with seeking to achieve things, but when we're driven by that need, then we get into trouble. Because, you know, the success of the thing, we actually want to, it's like a really good scientist or a researcher, they actually really want to find out the truth. So however many successes or failures, that's okay, that goes by the by, because they're not focused on the success, they're focused on the deeper thing, what we're doing it for. So it has to come back to the motivation. Why are you doing it?
And this could be a personal thing more than anything else, but I can really see that most of those I could really put in because of fear, that being the strong emotion, which, you know, fear of failure or fear of not being successful or fear of being criticised or fear of not being complimented. And that might be a personal thing, but that's the emotion which seems to be attached to all those things.
Yeah, so fear is a hugely powerful motivator. And actually, from a Buddhist psychology point of view, It's a very strong manifestation of what's called ignorance, so and self-grasping. So it is a symptom of having those things. So ignorance, not just being ignorant, but ignorance of a confusion about our nature and how we exist in the world. And then because we have that confusion, we're kind of like, you know, stumbling through the dark, or like Shakespeare said, like through a glass darkly. Then we're so petrified that we grasp onto the first thing that we think of, which is, this is me and this is what I want. And that becomes our main driving force. But it comes from this unawareness of who is this me. So from Buddhist psychology point of view, that's this fundamental ignorance or fundamental confusion that we have of not understanding reality, being dominated by cognitive fusion all the time. And because of that, then we grasp at things. And, of course, those things flow through our fingers like sand, like water, and then we have fear. So it's this step-by-step thing that Buddhist psychology shows how it comes about on that really deep instinctual level. But mostly the first thing that we know about that something's wrong is that we experience fear.
Yeah.
So that's a symptom that something's wrong.
Mm.
It's probably, it's actually not the thing that's wrong. It's the symptom of the thing that's wrong.
Yeah, and I get, well, and more broadly, anxiety or whatever you want.
Yeah, anxiety too. Anxiety is a symptom or a result of something being wrong. So we often think our anxiety is the problem, but it's not. It's because we have a problem, and it shows us that there is a problem there. So the anxiety actually is our friend. It's like back pain. Back pain is not the problem. Yeah. The cause of the back pain is the problem. So the pain is our friend, and it shows us where to look. And fear as well, it shows us where to look.
Yes. Fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, and fear is a huge one. I remember keeping a diary when I had to go for this new job, and I was just terrified. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to write down everything that I'm scared of. And it was pages of all the ways I could stuff up and everything that could go wrong and how people, you know, could think of me badly and I'd lose my house and la, la, la and everything. But then I just kept on going because each of those things I could do something about. And then right at the end I just came to, the thing I am terrified about is fear. I am afraid of fear. I'm afraid of that feeling. I'm afraid of uncertainty. So fear is like a bully, like that. It dominates you. And then once I went, oh, my God, I'm fearful of fear, I was free. I was like, oh, well, you can't do anything about that, so I'm just going to do it anyway. And I think many, many people will, instead of trying to get rid of fear or instead of trying to get rid of anxiety or get rid of that fear of failure, you just live with it. You just go, okay, that's the price of going deeper or having, you know, doing more. Whereas the worldly concerns, we have fear, it feels bad, and therefore we want to get rid of it. We think it is bad. But actually fear can be, it can be a thing that motivates us as well as crippling us.
Mm. A good analogy, like the doctors use, they want to know where your pain is so they know what to do, and it's like, tell us about the pain, and they always do that scaling question about pain. Mm-hmm. And that's their kind of test, you know, so that can be applied.
And if you don't have pain, they're really worried about you.
yeah, that's right, yeah.
So cognitive fusion goes, pain is bad. But that's a mistake. Pain is a sensation and it can be useful.
Mm.
It can be debilitating if we can't work with it, but it can also be really useful.
Mm.
And then even with social anxiety or anxiety about uncertainty, if we if we can carry that, then when we see other people that are also terrified or also shy or also riven with uncertainty, we can help them because we know what it's like. You know, we can like carry that burden for them. Whereas if we didn't have that experience, we wouldn't even notice they were suffering.
That's right. Yeah.
Or we'd find it even more uncomfortable to be near that person because it's such a trigger for yourself.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We just want to get away from them. So then there's two people beholden to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But I hear you. It's a powerful, powerful emotion. So or sensation, actually. But if you think of it as energy, as a powerful sensation, and be able to, as you probably already do, Mark, be able to kind of sit with it and bear it, I think you'll be able to use the energy from it.
Yeah. I think it's more sort of bigger issues in the world and life. You kind of recognize it in yourself, but then you probably don't recognize it when it's, you know, deciding not to go and talk to that person at work because it might be uncomfortable. It's the same thing, just on a smaller scale.
Yeah. So I mean, with that and social anxiety is or that discomfort that rules our society. And then just in a little self-help book I just read about, if you're shy in the room, you can bet that there is someone else that is more shy than you. So you carry their shyness, you take it on. And that's what helped me, because I'm like naturally introverted. So how on earth am I going to lead a class and welcome people at Lunbury Timber Centre? So what I think is, well, they're more shy than I am, so I'm going to carry their shyness for them.
Mm.
And it was really effective.
Yeah, interesting.
Miffy, on the journal sheets like that, I surprised myself and did it every day. And when you were talking last week about artists being in the zone sort of thing, I mean, I've used a few of my own words there, in that state of bliss. I've got a friend who's an artist and I had a chat to her about that. And I was thinking, oh, I don't really have anything. I mean, when I worked, I probably had a few things that I could really get immersed in. But this week I'm trying to get my exercise and everything up, and I went swimming, and I haven't, apart from one swim a couple of, I don't know, months back, I haven't done it for about 7 or 8 years. I'm not a good swimmer, and now I'm a woman of size, I'm carrying a bit. It's not just down to COVID. And I got in the pool and I did laps, and you know, some of them hurt, but I loved it. I just thought,
yeah,
I've found the bliss. And then I was able to kind of imagine that as, you know, that's kind of where you go to state of enlightenment. It was really lovely. And I probably wouldn't have achieved that without the bliss. Like,
oh, excellent.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, really fantastic, Anne. That's great. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of that comes from you putting the effort in, and then even if it's just for a few moments where everything is synchronized and harmonious, the laps, the breathing, the experience, and it's all one, and that sense of self and self-consciousness that falls away. So even just with something like that, naturally you get a feeling for it. Yeah. So I think sometimes when I had a real distressing time, I'd go for a walk, a really long walk along Brisbane River, and just the momentum of walking, after a while everything changes. So some of those things, crochet and that kind of pattern making and dressmaking, just because the hours I've spent doing it, I've been able to get into that kind of zone. So there can be very mundane things. I know people with gardening and with cooking also find that harmony. And part of it, and Mark, that'll probably relate to, you know, what you were saying, is when you're really involved in that thing, that self-consciousness just falls away.
Mm.
And it's such a relief.
Mm.
So, and Tracy, in your work, do you have a lot of competitiveness with your...
Definitely. I don't work in the health industry anymore. I'm a librarian in a private college now. And it's probably the most dysfunctional workplace I've ever worked in. It's very competitive, very silo oriented, and big blame culture. So it's a bit of a culture shock for me. But yeah. But I'm thinking, you know, like getting up and doing the positive motivation every morning will help to set the tone for the day and try to be a bit impervious to the slings and arrows that come my way. But
yeah, just remember why you were involved in that in the first place, like what you love about it in the first place, you know, which can be kind of convoluted by the slings and arrows. But yeah. Even this course, Tracy, came about from being invited by the Griffith postgraduate group, society or whatever, to come and give this course to help everybody because they are so anxious and competitive and unhappy postgraduates.
Yeah. And they lack resilience too, and I think that this would assist with that as well. Trying to be aware of those worldly concerns that a lot of young people are consumed with now.
Totally consumed, that's right. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's 8:30. Thank you so much. Really hope to see you next week as well.